Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, everybody. I am your host, Lon Strength, a.k.a. Sparky Lee. I am the founder and CEO of Legacy Programs Education Reentry. I just want to welcome everybody. We had a guest to speak on the felony murder rule out in California. So next, we're going to postpone that for next week. If anyone has any information, questions, comments, please tune in next week. We will have Joanne, and she will be she'll give us insight. She's been following them very closely and has a lot of insight into the whole process and information that's available. So as far as I'm concerned, she's a professional when it comes to this. We had a wonderful show last week with Miriam Bart, Miriam Jacobs, sorry. And she gave a lot of insight and just had a lot to offer as from a doctor's perspective. And it just clarifies what's going on in the determining factors of, you know, why a crime is committed. I can't say anything enough good about her. You know, it's one of those things that woman is amazing what she does. She's very smart, and always have good conversations with her when it comes to post-incarceration stress syndrome, when it comes to prison politics. For somebody that's never been in prison, she sure does know a lot about what goes to the minds. So, I give her all the credit and the hard work that she's put into, just with everything. So I'm kind of lost today because, we don't have a guest. That's my fault. So it's probably going to be a shorter show today rather than the hour that I normally do. But I do want to invite anybody, if anybody wants to donate to keep the show going. It's at $NVO Shedding Light on Cash App. We're also still looking for pro bono lawyers to take on prison misconduct, which is where the families can get some closure on the stuff that's happening within the prison of being mistreated. So if anyone knows a lawyer that wants out in California and any state in California, please let us know. Good news, I just had a buddy of mine that I did time with parole. He was a lifer, and he is out now. And he contacted me this morning. It was pretty cool to give him insight on parole and the process and life. And he did over 20 years. And it was a great opportunity for me to reach my hand out to help those that are going through something similar that I have overcome or in the process of overcoming. So I do think mentoring is one of the biggest things in reentry. Looking back a year and a half ago when I got released, everyone knows my story where I was released homeless with $200 in my pocket. My wife had to, they weren't transferring my parole to the home that I had. I actually have a home with my name on it. And they were playing games. They made me go back to county commitment. So I had to stay there for 90 days. And while I was there, I stayed with my pastor and his wife. A church that I burglarized. I burglarized their church when I was 15 years old. And ever since then, I've been part of the church. They accepted me. They brought me in instead of pushing me out. And so I'd stay with them. And being down south compared to, when my family's 13 hours away, it was pretty rough. All my support network was up here. I had a job waiting for me. I had a program willing to accept me. I had my home, I had my family, everything was here. So I had to come over, overcome that diversity where it was, how do you make lemonade out of oranges? It was one of the deals that was very frustrating. So like I said, I didn't have an ID because the prison did not release me with an ID, as they said they do. But yeah, it's a parole violation if you don't have one and you get pulled over. They have a birth certificate. I wasn't even in the system because I did so much time. that I didn't even exist. And anytime my social popped up, it was fraud because they still had me down as incarcerated. So, you know, we talk about all this stuff, like, what is a successful and permanent reentry? A successful and permanent reentry is a support network, first and foremost. Whether that be your family, whether it be your wife, whether it be a program, or just complete strangers, you need that support network. A lot of my family, you know, I talk to pretty much just my brother and my uncle, but other than that, you know, my family is very toxic. You know, the one I grew up with, or grew up without. And so I had to, that was very frustrating because they were kind of more for my demise than they were for my success. And the more I did, it just didn't go over right. You know, I was doing all the right stuff, but because I was doing it as an individual and not under their care, it was different. And so permanent successful reentry is, you know, people lean on mentoring. Mentoring is key. I have a mentoring show that did a lot of time with me a while back ago. And, you know, what helped me was when I was able to call him at any point, day or night, and say, hey, Shaw, I'm having an issue, man. And he was there. You know, he talked me through it. And his favorite word was, I've been through that. I know exactly what you're going through. And, you know, just having that, you know, that ear to lean on. And it was pretty cool because I'd call him and, you know, he'd be friends. He'd be at a party or with his friends or family. He would actually walk away from whatever he was doing to make sure I was okay because my phone call took priority. He knew as soon as I popped up, regardless of his family time, personal time, he took that time for me. And so he really helped me get to this point. A year and a half later, you know, I sit there and I look back of all the stuff I have, I've done, and I have, you know, I have more clothes than I could count. I have a union job. I have my own car. I'm back home with my family. I just bought a 65-inch TV, and I'm actually getting my teeth done. I'm getting my teeth capped. So that's huge. I bought cabinets for the family, for the home. I got we ended up buying a new washer and dryer. So, you know, leading up to this point of, you know, how do you go from homeless, ex-con, nothing in your pocket to being in a situation where you're a provider now, you know, where you're able to stand on your own 2 feet. And I get a lot of joy out of that. Being who I am. And, you know, I still struggle. We talk about the picks all the time, and it's a real thing. It's not one of the things that you could just, he's just weird or, you know, just not feeling it. It's a real thing. Like, there's a mental battle going on, even though you see somebody that's formerly incarcerated with a smile. That smile is usually, you know, there's something behind it. You know, how can this guy smile or this woman smile with all this stuff going bad? And most of the time it's just a facade. It's fake as hell. And it's, you know, we don't want to feel no pity. We don't want people to feel sorry for us. We just want to process it. And our processing is a little different. My processing is a little different. It takes me a minute. My first instinct is violence. My first instinct is aggression, you know, and it just doesn't work that way. So, you know, it is what it is. But a support network is key, you know, wanting to be accepted in the neighborhood. My neighborhood, they're accepting of me. They tolerate me. I mean, we don't go out to lunch and, you know, and stuff like that, but, you know, we're still, my neighbors are for my success. So, 605, are you listening?
Yeah, this is Chinupa. How you all doing? Haven't heard from you guys in a long time.
Man, work's been busy. I've been just living my best, right? How you been?
Oh, you know me. If it ain't a fight for kids, it's for elders. It ain't for elders or the kids, it's the people.
That's right.
Listen, what was your topic today on your show?
Just talking about support network within the community. You know, why is it important to have a support network with one of us coming home? And so next week's going to be Joanne for the felony murder rule, that this law that they put in. And the law is which you could be in the car with somebody that kills somebody, and you're just as liable as the person that pulled the trigger. And so we're talking about that and how we're trying to abolish it and deal with it. And today I'm just kind of going on a rant, leaving the lines open for whatever you guys want to talk about. I was talking about the coming home support network, having people you can call, you can talk to, and the community coming together for permanent and successful reentry.
Well, let me kind of amplify on something that's kind of unique, and it's going to get devastating for the reservations. Congress is looking at an avenue to try to give states power of authority to intervene on avenues that will harm our children, like they've done back in the late 50s, early 60s. This is why they enacted the Indian Child Welfare Act. But nonetheless, the states want to have jurisdiction over, criminal and, civil affairs within reservation boundaries. Now, it's a case that's been, brought out by different congressional officials because they're not getting their fair shake of how tribal governments operate within the reservation boundaries. Needless to say, the way the system works is they don't really want to embark on what Indian country means, okay? Indian country is the whole continent of Turtle Island, which, the Caucasian folk call America or the United States. In my books, they don't exist. Okay? But that's what you have a propagated issue because a lot of the people don't understand that reservations is a tract of land that they forced us on. Now, they're going to test case this avenue to give jurisdictions to the state within the state of Oklahoma because of the dumping grounds of the Legal Removal Act. During when they dispersed a lot of the Cherokees and Choctaws and Chickasaws and Cuyagas and, many other brands of tribes that lived out in the East Coast. And they put them on the Trail of Tears. And so now that they dumped them off in Oklahoma, which they labeled Oklahoma as the Indian Territories, you will see that America is trying to repeat history by stripping the children's lives away from a said family, yet alone go after, the rights that, natives have if they're a sovereign entity within a said reservation boundary. But here's the catch, folks. Native people, okay, our people in general, your brethren, the native people, we have always been subjugated to colonial rule on this part. Okay, this is what really gets people. What is Indian country? Okay, and why was Indian country established within the course of history? Well, most people would not even understand what that means. Well, I'll give you just a small history of it, and then I'll give it back to Lawrence to carry on. You see, when you look at Indian country, And I think it's under 18 USC 1151. So there's a number of clauses that come with that abridged form of law. Okay. As, you know, mentioned in history how, you know, the Indian Removal Act was affecting certain tribes in Indian country. But Indian country itself divides a primitive, you know, strength of people that would reside within whatever state they're from. Okay? Except the otherwise provided in certain sections. So Indian country, on the other hand, as used in certain terms and in textbooks, means all land within the limits of any Indian reservation under the so-called jurisdiction of, you know, the United States government, okay? And it's also has a little remark of notwithstanding the assurance of any patent, okay, which latterly, a good example is to, when you look at the highways or the rights of way running through reservation, power lines, train tracks, and all this, all those so-called dependent Indian communities within the borders of the so-called American government, whether they were original or subsequently acquired to a territory, one of the things that keep arising in Indian country is that we native people don't know how to handle native affairs, okay? This is why they're using this form of a jurisdiction to try to come after our kids again. And this is a thing that a lot of the tribes have gotten away from understanding how to protect and serve our people. So the rights of way, hello?
Hello?
Yeah, talk to me.
All right, brother.
So,
me and Romaine got into our big storage. Uh-huh. We were able to make enough room except for the couch. The couch is gone.
Okay.
The beds are still there.
Okay.
So we were able to get rid of the little storage and hold on to our big one, and the beds are all there.
Okay.
Hey, the couch is gone. Real quick. Sure.
Okay.
You good? I'm going to meet you real quick. Oh, okay. So, yeah. So I don't understand the laws and stuff like that. And it's ridiculous how they're able to just kind of insert themselves in our government into just situations that, you know, and like the brother Chinupo was saying is that, you know, they're what they're doing is because they want their fair share. And, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this is all kind of Indian land. You can't walk on your neighbor's yard and you just go over there and say it's yours. I mean, but I don't know. That's just my opinion. And I might catch flack for that. But, you know, I don't know. Oh. You know, politics is a mother. It is so. I don't know. But and also, you know, there's a lot of injustices going on right now. And one of the from the FPCA Ohio, which is ran by Lindsay, we were just talking about advocates in every state. And that's what she's trying to put together, and that's huge right there. You know, we should have. There's a guy I'm advocating for, and you know, we didn't have the best history, and one of our mutual friends, he goes, why do you do what you do? Like, forget him, and I just have a policy. You know, we fight for one, we fight for all, because once I start once I start crossing that line one time or even thinking about it, what happens is it's going to turn into a habit eventually. Eventually, I'm going to want to, I think I get away with it, and I'm like, you know, you're absolutely right. No. As an advocate, we fight for all. And I may not like you. I may not like anything about you, but I still fight for your rights. And that's what we do as advocates, because, you know, we are the voice of the voiceless. We are the ones that give the power back and the humanity back to the people coming home. And not only for the people coming home, but also for the people behind the walls. So we have Snoopa, you're back.
Yeah, I apologize for that. That was my other phone from some outside resources that are calling that they got some beds and couches for my elders here on Pine Ridge. But let me finish that piece off just to make it real quick, because all of Indian country is vested upon, you know, different highways, whether they're I-90s, I-80s, I-70s. Those are all part of Indian country, which is America, okay? So when they making this attempt to try to neutralize, you know, the people's kids again, this is what's going to cause a great controversy against them. And that's how it always works. Any Indian who, you know, has family and property need to start protecting them very thoroughly, because they're going to try to enact again the public law 280s, where the states are always saying they have the effective right to come into Indian country, which in modern speaking, they don't. And so I wanted to share that with you guys today. And Lawrence, keep your show going. It's great. And yeah, Indian people's sovereignty is always under attack, man, by these colonial practices that want to neutralize human rights. And so it's no different than somebody being incarcerated. I'll kid you not to this, folks. People don't have to get charged and sent to the Caucasian people's prison institutions, okay, industrial complexes. They don't have to. It's already on the books. But the problem is, see, they're labeling us as citizens. We're not citizens of the United States' way of dealing with Native people. We are not. Our people need to get that concept out of their hearts and their brain, because now that you bear your name, okay, take for instance, and this is just a brief thing. Lawrence, his name is Lawrence. That's a Caucasian's name, even through the Bible, Lawrence of Arabia, okay? So Lawrence has two benefactors of a name, but yet they still treated him as them, and then they locked him up. Now, remember, little brother Lawrence told the history of his own individual self and his brother, how they were living in orphanages and so forth. This is what America has done to people in Europe. It was created over there because of the homelessness and a lot of the separations from families. So kids were brought up that way. And it's not nobody's fault. It's the system's fault, because back in the times of kingdoms and garrisons, this is how they isolated people from having outside, you know, contact with nature, and they stripped them from that. So now you got people all under a colonial control, and now you're all, you know, affgated, which, if you never heard of the term affgated, means you're branded with a number. Merle Haggard came out with a song called that. Remember, A Branded Man? I'd like to hold my head up and be proud of who I am, but they won't let my secrets go untold. So he was singing that song about penitentiaries, how they were treating people. So now I'm a branded man out in the cold. You know, he wrote that song because it was a true song, how they were teaching people in the institutions. And that's how Merle Haggard became a famous country singer, because he was writing about jails. Not only him, and there's a few other ones, but he was the main one that opened up that opportunity to see how America done things to people of color. So I'll rest it back with you, and thank you. I'm going to listen in. Thanks, Lawrence, for allowing me to come on.
Snoopa, always a pleasure, man. You give – I love your history lessons behind all your statements. It's beautiful. You know, that's the problem, is that we it's crazy how the government just throws us aside and call it, gives us a title, and you know, we lose our rights, and that's the problem, folks. Is if anybody's listening right now and you're going, well, these are Indians there, this has nothing to do with me, let me tell you how this begins with you, is that this is where it starts. They start with a little population of people, and then they keep moving up and up until eventually, this is how it works. They're going to get the middle class, the lower middle class. I grew up poor, and I'm going to tell you right now, we are affected just as much as any other race. I mean, it happens. This is this is not just a race issue. It starts as a race issue. It ends up being a class issue. And we have to get on top of this. And this is why I like the education that Snoop up, because he brings the education that's necessary to know your rights. Because if you don't know your rights and you're having somebody telling you what you can and can't do, you're going to follow those guidelines. And those guidelines are set up for a brainwashed mentality. And it cripples us. Because they tell you, you know, you go the speed limit. So the next thing you know, you're driving down the street. There's no speed limit sign. You're thinking you're going 55, when actually in that speed limit is probably 65 or lower. But this is about the thing about education, is that we have to – I love this show and how we're able to bring everyone together and to explore these options and these injustices that go on and on throughout the United States. That this isn't just going to start and end with one population. This is going to end with – all the populations, and that's how I see it. Because in prison, that's how they did it. They started with a small races. They hit the others. They hit the AMIs, and then they hit the whites, and then they hit the Mexicans, the blacks, and eventually it's a policy. I've seen it, and like I said earlier, you know, well, Chupa said this is as far as I see it. This is all Indian land still. You know, you can't walk on your neighbor's yard and just say it's yours. but that's what the government does. And it's not an individual. It's not, to me, this is my personal opinion. It's not a race of people. It's a race of class. And they're making the rules and the policies for us to follow mindless and to sit there and to follow their suit. And what happens is you have these supporters and they give this propaganda where they're like, yeah, you know, white power, white pride, or, you know, whatever, and we jump on that, and all of a sudden, we're with them, and let me tell you something, people, we are not with them. The people that make the policies, they are so against us, it's ridiculous. So, just so you know. And we have 380 on. I believe that's Lindsay and Glenn.
Hi, Sparky. James Cronenberger with Federal Prisoners Coalition for Action.
Oh, there you are. Hey, what's up?
Yes. Well, I had a couple of things I want to comment. One was about Native American. Years ago at Grafton Correctional, they would force the Native Americans to get a haircut. They would actually hold them down in the seat until they filed a federal lawsuit against the Department of Corrections and won. So you're right about how unfair people are treating, you know, others, not just Native Americans or blacks, but other people that, you know, even the gay community, they're all getting discriminated, you know, throughout the country in almost every prison. And I wanted to share a little bit what we're doing in Ohio. We're trying to get people to assist us, you know, like with, you know, to join our board and help instead of everything to be left on Lindsay. Right now, we want to help prisoners when they get out with housing, employment, getting their birth certificate, just basically anything we can. And right now, we don't have the manpower to really assist us. And it's not just, you know, this group. It was the other groups I was involved with as well. We struggle because you can't run an organization without financial assistance or people helping you. And I don't know if you've fallen into, you know, have had problems with people assisting you like we do.
California is actually
So the California process of housing our formerly incarcerated or our returned citizens, as I like to call them, is very technical. And, like right now we have a lot of lifers and LWAPs coming home, which is like about the possibility, because they've shown through the years that they're rehabilitated. But what happens is that they can only save a bed. Like transitional housing you see in California, as far as resources, the problem that I see with the resources that are available for anybody that's coming home is that you have these people, and when I see these people, it just depends on who's doing the screening process of, you know, who they let in, who they don't. And they discriminate by race, creed, and sex, all the time. So, you know, like, for instance, when I see guys going to getting out and there's a program for formerly incarcerated, and as soon as they run their name, they give them the runaround. They don't tell them they're denied. They tell them that, oh, have your POs in the email. And then when they send an email, they say they didn't hear it. But the resources that are in California, there's so much money in that. As soon as most of the organizations out here get that money, they pocket it and they close down the gates. So that's as far as as much as I know out here.
They're doing the same. They do the same stuff in Ohio, Sparky. And another thing too is it's hard to find housing for people of different crimes, sex offenders, arson. There's no way people are going to let them in a halfway house because of insurance. But sex offenders are really discriminated, and say if you have to go into assisted living, there's not one in Ohio that will accept you. You know,
that makes sense.
You know, so, and it's sad because they're still people. They might have done something wrong. Maybe they're innocent. Who knows? But, you know, they fall in the category of being discriminated as well.
Okay, so I don't particularly side with the system, but I do have insight on the procedure with this. And what happens is when a transitional house sets up, they have a zoning policy. And so they have to declare what crimes have been committed and who are their housing in that area. And in order to get one for like 290s and stuff like that, It's more paperwork, it's more money, and it's more IDs and insurance. So that's
right.
Why, like, some of these organizations and these transitional houses, it's not that they don't want to, it's just that they can't.
Right, and I do believe you in that, but they need to find a place for them to go. You do not, what they're doing in Ohio right now, they're releasing people homeless, or just release people without a place to go. You don't want a person that was addicted to drugs, a sex offender, an arsonist, a murderer, just running around without some kind of structured guide. You know, and that's what's happening.
But
in
you
also Ohio.
Have to understand, you know, that these people that they are letting out, they're hoping they go back. The reason why they release people homeless,
money,
is because human nature is it's all about money. I mean, we're still, parolees are still worth that amount, almost up to $100,000 a year to the full system, to CDCR and DOC. But what happens is when they release somebody homeless that has no resources, they are banking
right.
on the fact that they go back. Because in human nature, we go to what we know best. So if you have somebody, a booster, as they call them out here, or somebody that relates to criminal activity, and you release them homeless without a birth certificate, without an ID, and all the necessities to actually be productive, they're gonna go.
Right.
They're gonna resort back to the crime to their crime of choice, because that's pretty much what we know. You know, criminal thinking. Just because we go to prison for X amount of years doesn't mean that we lose the criminal thinking. I think criminal all the time. It's just I don't act on it anymore. But there's still those loopholes and those shortcuts that consist of criminal thinking.
Hey, Sparky. It's Lindsay. I'm going to chime in here. I'm the founder of the FPCA, the Federal Prisoners Coalition for Action. I wanted to chime in because I know exactly what you're saying, because what I just dealt with 4 months ago in trying to help someone with my advocacy, that he did what he needed to do to get back into prison. And that's all I really can say about it at this point. And knowing that this person had to go back to what he knew best in order to find housing, to find food, was to go back to prison. And that's unfortunate that that's the mindset of someone who's coming out instead of a positive outlook, having a driver's license, having a state ID, having a birth certificate, having these things that they need to even fill out a job application or a W-4. That's the problem, where the reentry programming within every state is pretty much nationwide. I've talked to people in Oklahoma, Florida, Louisiana, Illinois, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And all of these prisoners have the same exact, they're afraid to come out because they don't think they're going to be able to make it. And they have a plan, like, well, if I'm not going to make it, I'm just going to figure out how to go back in. And that is so completely unfair, you know, that we need to make the government accountable. And again, if the government's not going to do their job, we have to find funding. We have to find people that are willing to reach out and branch out and try to figure out how to get these people to come back into society, you know, because genuinely, even though what happened to me, I still care about prisoners. I still care about people. You know, I don't think that what happened to me should have happened had he had the resources he needed. And that's really all I have to say on that.
Well, you know who I held accountable for this are the organizations that are supposed to help. You know, but then this is what pisses me off about this, is that you'll have these big-ass organizations, and I'm not even going to name their names because
one.
Go ahead.
I'm just kidding.
Okay. Well, like, for instance, I have friends that work for these different organizations, and there's this one in particular that they get millions of dollars. And they do absolutely nothing with it but pad their pockets. I blame
look at Susan G. Komen Foundation. Do you know how much the CEO of that organization makes a year? $200,000 a year. $200,000 a year she makes. Yeah.
To
run an organization. I literally beg people so that I can have JPay stamps to message prisoners so that they know somebody cares about them.
Well, and that's the problem. It's just like, if you knew the work that Chinupa does, you know, he's a hole in the wall, you know. But he's not getting multi-million dollar funding. And you got all these small organizations, even myself. Most of my funding comes from my paycheck.
I was lucky to raise the $50 in order to register with the state of Ohio. And now I'm trying to work on my 503. 501. I always call it 503. I know it's 501. But
501,
even just to get started on that level, to get people to even donate so that I can even start anything, has been completely stressful. I'm working a job now so that I can make money, just so that I can send it to indigent prisoners who don't have family and friends, so they can have a nice pair of shoes or maybe a sundries box. You know what I mean?
Yep. No, that's much needed. That's part of the support network I talk about, is that, you know, being down for 20 years myself, I could speak on the dehumanization and the alienation from the society and the world, and how it shapes your character and your habits and your behavior. And, you know, it's very important to have outside connections to give you those resources, because this is the thing. A lot of guys and gals are going in, and there's no, you know, my role models for 20 years were serial killers and high profile gang members. Those were my heroes, you know. And the reason why they were my heroes is because I didn't have anybody in my community reaching out and showing me better. They sat there and they disregarded me.
Well, and I know a big part of it is people say, well, I'm here with you, but I don't know what to do. And at some point you're like, well, honestly, if I, you know, the catalyst, like, I have, there's going to be an outing in Ohio for the Columbus Clippers. We're going to just do an outing where people can buy tickets. We don't even get any of the money. We just want our name on the scoreboard so that we can get some sort of recognition in this location only. Then the Cleveland Monsters came after us and said, hey, we saw that you were interested in wanting to do some fundraising, and they're like, hey, we want to help you, you know, get some funding to get behind you because we believe in what you're trying to do. See, the problem is you got 10 mini organizations, and then you got the one big organization that's taking all the cases, taking all the clients, taking all the prisoners, and not doing anything with it. And then they want you to join them, and then you get stuck with not being able to do anything.
But let's.
I know with
the
FPCA and Ohio Cure, we're trying to do the best that we can. We have a bill that's being written up for reentry and reform of prison in the state of Ohio.
Well, let's go a step further. All this funding, where is it going? Like, who's it going to?
Where is it going?
I asked that question to the
Ohio Department of Corrections. I asked that question. That was the only question they left blank.
Yeah, and it makes sense because it's all, you know, everyone's padding each other's pockets while, you know, the rich is getting rich and the poor is getting poorer. And
here's the way I'm looking at it. It's, we use that statement with children where it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to raise an inmate that comes out and they're brand new, like they've never been out in society before. How do we expect them to act? What are our expectations and why are they so high? And we don't have what it takes to give these people what they need to just get a, it's not a handout, it's a hand up. Give them a hand up. Let's get them where they need to be so they can be productive.
A lot of times, what you mean about psychology is that it's out of sight, out of mind. You know, a lot
yeah,
of times.
Yeah, if it's not just, there, it doesn't exist. That's because I'm 5 feet. I know what you're saying because if it's above my head, it doesn't exist. People need to start seeing through the looking glass and get out of that bottle and get out of their norm and be like, oh, my God, this is actually a problem. And it's the only thing that's been happening for the last 30, 40 years, I'd say 40 years, when the crack epidemic happened, not heroin, crack started it back in the 80s, guaranteed. And then you got products of drug addicts and drug dealers and the children, and that's all they know. So it's been a train wreck the entire time. And everybody just turns a blind eye to it. And you know the government started putting drugs on the street. We all know that.
Absolutely, every time. But it's kind of like one of those things with, so I'm an HVAC technician, right? And this is how it normally works. You know the only time they call a technician for an AC unit? When it's broken.
No.
That's it. They don't call to
if it's not
it
broke,
to,
don't fix it. But we absolutely know the system is completely disgusting.
Yeah,
and broke.
And that's what they do. They, you know, until an inmate comes out and does a mass shooting, then it will be addressed or something traumatic, and then all of a sudden it's an issue. But the normal people,
the one thing back in January, February, when the federal lockdown happened because of Beaumont, that I looked at was the federal budget and where that money is going. The money that they say they spend on building and maintenance is total BS. Because the inmates do all the building and maintenance. So who's getting that money? Like, where is that actually going? Because it's a flat-out lie.
They're paying them 15 cents an hour, or probably like 30
cents.
Yeah,
and it's slave labor. If my husband got a job, he'd be making like $3 an hour doing laundry. But during COVID, you weren't allowed to have a job because they had him locked up for 23 hours a day. And FCI Manchester is now on lockdown because two COs tested positive for COVID, so they're locking him up again for 23 hours a day.
Yeah, they're doing the same thing in California. LA
and
is
you know
going
what?
Back
in Ohio, inmates make
month.
18 cents an hour. They make like $18 a month, if that.
Yes.
That's slave wage.
Here's the kicker.
They should be allowed to make minimum wage. I'm sorry.
Okay, so this is the kicker about what inmates make in prison. Not only do they make cents on the dollar, there's a 5% processing fee that the prison gets for keeping your books. And there's a, in California, there's a 50% restitution.
So
I've not talked to my low in federal prison about that, but I'm pretty sure he's afraid to say anything over the phone because it's the federal government. But as far as state prisoners, they've never really discussed anything about, you know, what they make in Ohio.
Yeah.
But
well, I
it's disgusting.
We make from nothing next to, I think, the most I've made was 50 cents. And that's a building maintenance.
In Ohio, it's
so,
$15 to $18 a month.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much what we got. I got $21 a month after the 55% was taken. And that's not just working eight-hour days. That's working,
well,
know,
it's
eight,
12
10.
For high facilities, 15 for medium, and then 18 for low, I think it was. I'm not 100%. 21 for low, 18 for medium security. So it's based on your security level, not the fact that you could actually do the job.
Which makes no sense because you're doing just as hard of labor in there as you are anywhere else.
Here's the problem. Just because they're incarcerated doesn't mean that they shouldn't earn a living. Do you know what I mean? Like, how do you not earn minimum wage or pay taxes? And, like, what, 30% of commissary and the FBLP goes towards recreational stuff, but it's supposed to, but it doesn't. Like, they get one DVD a week, and they haven't even gotten that since COVID.
Or a basketball every year.
A basketball. Like, what, or a pair of shoes with the FBLP is $80. An MP3 player is $90. Like,
I just bought my
new pair of shoes, or you got to pick your food for the frickin' 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, Lawrence, I mean, I remember, Lawrence, you know, the same shoes that I bought
Lawrence.
In prison, I bought out here for $30. Yes.
Okay.
Lawrence, this is Chinupa.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Hey. Yes, sir.
Okay. What's the young lady's name?
Lindsay?
My name is Lindsay Claire.
Okay, Lindsay, this is Chinupa from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation here in South Dakota. You know,
How are you?
What kind of solution are you looking for that involves these industrial complexes, meaning the newly established concentration camps, okay, because that's what a prison is, like a reservation.
It's exactly what it is.
So what kind
I'm
of...
I'm trying to figure out why everything has to be a policy and not by law.
Okay, I'll tell you why.
No laws.
Okay, this is why I've been trying
to
help. This is why I've been trying to help people get their mindset back into what alleviates the conditions they're in. The current establishments of every, penal complex, state, and county facilities all. Masterminded by the rich people. Okay, they found ways to make money.
Here's the one problem that I have
is
that we have to pay millions of dollars because someone was wrongfully convicted or innocent, and we have to pay millions of dollars to these people.
Yes, yes. Okay, so
how much
so you're looking for a solution to that, okay? One thing I've been doing, okay, one thing I've been doing to help people that are incarcerated, okay, It's what they call a residential bowder, if you ever heard of it, like clam chowder, bowder, residential bowder, okay? The reason why I brought this subject up to the BOP about 65 days ago, I was asking them, are you in prison right now, sir? And so the board was looking at me kind of, you know, in a state of euphoria, like, what do you mean? I said, answer the question. You answered all the stuff that you wanted to hear from us, and we gave you the answer. But now I'm asking you, are you incarcerated? And the board looked at me with dismay. Well, I can't answer that. The reason why you can't answer it is because you're still in jail, too. And then so the lady on the board, the Bureau of Prisons, she said, how do you figure? I said, do you own a home? They said, yes. This is why it becomes residential bowder. Because even you are living in your own prison. You just don't recognize it because it's controlled movement. You have to have a key or a special alarm to get in.
Even if I owned my own home outright, I still got to pay property taxes.
That's right. So see, this is why prisons are the same way. That's why it becomes a residential barter, okay? A residential barter means that what takes care of you, you turn around and take care of it too, vice versa.
Right.
Reverse psychology. But here's the catch. The natural and the neutral wealth of these sources have become very racial and prejudiced. Why do I say racial and prejudiced? Because they do not want nobody else intervening, but you have to make an attempt to do this on a human right level. That's how residential barters become exposed in the way people are dealing with politics out there. Because you know this as well as I do, Lawrence. When you were in the institution, you had to have a pass to get to one place to another, right or wrong?
Correct.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely right.
So under that control movement, that alleviates the pressure of a guard trying to transfer you to the library or the educational field or your work ethic. You see, this is how control movement works. So residential barters aimed it on that because there was no covenant of a political civil virtue inside those policies and procedures of every said institution, even the private sector. That's how they do this. So that so-called, you know, right to your, excuse me, where they say individuals that are incarcerated have a limited right of going to the commissary, getting a job. And Lawrence said something best that caught my interest. When I was in prison years ago, I mean, this is when I was a child, back when I was 13 years old for knocking that cop off. I was under slave labor too, but I wasn't making what Lawrence was making. I was making 15 cents a day. 15.
Oh, wow.
That's barely enough to get you your personal hygiene and whatever necessity you might have to get from the canteen or commissary, because everything's supposed to be underneath the market value of a dollar, which nowadays is probably horrendously high. My point is that because there's not enough people out there making that stink, but thanks to my brother and good friend named Mark Faggart, who is a criminal attorney out of Texas, he banded together to help me with all these other people that have this quest for the residential barter to eliminate that and give it back to what the institutions need as certain programs from these institutions that have certain brothers and sisters that have a group oriented movement in there.
Can I interject for 1 second? Is that there are no programs. It's about the
brothers. That's right. Exactly what you're saying. Yes, you have to do that. Every time a crisis happens out here, they take rights away from people inside, even the programs. Okay? You can't do that because nobody's stressing it on a political and human right endeavor. That's why that covenant, what I'm expressing to you, this is the way I've helped these guys get it. So now 16 states' institutions are being investigated.
There's also a presidential candidate that's coming up that has filed 32 lawsuits in each state that is filing against violations for the 14th Amendment. His name is Andy Williams Jr., also known as Hood Candidate. He's been a major contributor to ideas and information for my organization. And, you know, I'm such an infant in, you know, starting all of this. So I've had great knowledge and understanding with Mr. Cronenberger. But what I'm trying to say is that this person wants to become president and change the prison systems and change how we do so many things. And it's important that people understand that, you know, he's been trying to change so much for so long. Amazing person. He was a gangster, been in prison, changed his life, became a lawyer. He's been working with legislation out of Illinois. He absolutely, everything that you just said is what he stands for.
And that's the nature that we must all put our support on individuals that are making an attempt to fix the problem. Nothing will ever get done until you, as I say it in the white world, no offense to the listening audience that are Caucasian, the white world has always been meddling with politics and even the incarceration of people by sticking their nose where it don't belong.
I am actually disgusted to be... I'm actually disgusted, so I think no.
So okay, I appreciate that. So that's kind of the sanitation of this behavior going after him, because you know, going before that board that of the Bureau of Prisons, they tried to act minute in certain policies and procedures through a handbook that was created for some of these private sectors that are being created. They are. If you're not aware of it, they're out there. There's a lot of private sectors that a lot of these billionaires are tapping into. And they're trying to build, you know, they're trying to call it a cultural development program. Whoa.
That is the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. I thought we were all supposed to be unified.
Yes, that's what's happening.
Like,
so let's say a person wants to have a good paying job. Because a lot of the institutions that have people incarcerated, they're the ones that are making these highline cables for these big corporations. People don't know that. They're also making the military boots for certain military people.
I think, and I tried a couple of times, at least with six different local newspapers, like I just tried to get in with investigative journalists and find somebody that had a passion about this kind of stuff. And it's really hard to find any like resources for anybody to want to write about anything, because honestly, society doesn't want to hear about it. So how do we get them to want to hear about this issue, the issues that we have? How do we get society to even recognize it? Because they're looking at a black mirror. They're on their phone all day.
Okay.
They're distracted. Okay. They're tired. They come from a broken home. They're dealing with so many other issues other than, you know, the issues.
Let me show you and let me teach you how we can help each other explain and amplify this whole strategy, okay? Because it's going to become a psychological and a mental health issue with the integrity of a human being. Okay?
One question I have for you. I've been in state penitentiaries for psychiatric care. Why aren't prisons run more like that? Because most people that are incarcerated have a dual diagnosis. It's not that they're a criminal, but they might have had drug and alcohol issues, mental health issues, all of that. Why are we not running them like a psychiatric facility? I want an answer to that.
Well, they did have them, but because of the
they couldn't give me an answer.
Let me put it this way, and I know you have a lot of great issues and interest of what's going on in the legal system, especially the industrial complex of prisons, okay? The genetic resources is like seeds. In other words, medicines, okay? But the lack of these understandings that people have is the lack of knowledge how to operate and orchestrate and run an institution, whether it's a FCI, a state and federal penitentiary, however name you call it, even central
you can have a bachelor's
incarceration, okay?
You can have
so the economic activities that go on in these places, okay, they exclude what people are supposed to be providing, how to safeguard an institution.
And
okay,
what is
this is the problem. Here's what's going to scare you, ma'am. What's going to scare you? And forgive me if I called you ma'am, okay? They have a little canister the size of a CO2 tank that they can stick in their Freon valve of every institution. And if this country's under a major crisis, they'll kill every inmate.
No, I know
they'll
that.
They'll screw it in there and boom, kill them all.
No, I know.
This is what people don't see out there. So this information that we all calculate and record and have, we're not sharing it on a broader scale. But we can if we all stick together on the minute things that are prevalent enough for us to hear and see. This is why I'm sharing this with you.
That's
Lawrence, I'm going to give it back to you because I think you're probably going to end the show.
Yeah, no, it already went over. I think it cut us off. But I want to thank all my guests today. Join us next week.
Thank you, Sparky.
This is a great conversation. No problem. Thank you, Snoopa. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, Jim. Y'all are amazing. Stay blessed and have a wonderful day. I hope.
No.
Thanks, Sparky. It was nice to meet you.
No problem. Nice to meet you again.